Welcome to episode 109 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. The autumn colour has officially arrived, at least if we chase it about a bit. Today we're going to look through some of my shots from a recent trip to Shigakogen, a highland plateau in the Nagano Prefecture, northwest of Tokyo. I visited this location twice last year too, which I spoke about in episodes 58 and 59 of this podcast. This year was another adventure, with me again deciding to drive at night to get to a popular vantage point early enough to actually get a parking space. This time we actually booked the following two nights in a nice little hotel too, and made a bit of a break out of it. So let's just sit down and talk about my experiences over the 3 days. Well, it was a bit of a rushed plan again. The colour of the leaves on the trees was starting to change a few weeks later than usual because of the unseasonably warm September that we had here in Japan. On Wednesday, the 10th of October, though, things were starting to turn around and the weather was looking up a little bit. So I called a small hotel in the Shigakogen area and booked a room for Thursday and Friday night to give me some time to really sort of work the area. The hotel was a really nice family-run hotel called Green. I'll put a link to their website in the show notes, but it's in Japanese, so maybe it won't be much help to many of you. To be honest, the visit was a little early, though. I was keeping my eyes on the leaves, the websites that show you sort of what things are like out there. But the yellow-coloured leaves were not really there yet in the lower parts of the plateau. The urushi, though, which is the small bushes that they take the Japanese lacquer from, this was in really sort of beautiful bright red and orange colours, and it was looking great. I would like to go back again right now, to be honest, it's a couple of weeks since I was there, but it's a 4-hour drive and I'm a little bit busy in the day job, so I'm not going to get away in the week. And a few things that I've got planned over the next weekend are probably going to prevent me from getting back at the best time. There are other things, other times. You know, next year is always going to be there unless something catastrophic happens. So I'll just save this, I think, this particular location for another visit next year. I hit the road this time at about 9:20 p.m. on the Wednesday night and was heading for the Shibutoge, which is basically a mountain pass that I mentioned last year too. After a steady sort of 4-hour drive, we pulled up into a small, maybe a 10-car lay-by at the side of the mountain, and that was at around 1:30 a.m. I was relieved to find that there were still a couple of parking spaces left, but even though it's almost at freezing point, the crazy photographers, of which I'm pleased to say I'm one, were already there. There was a couple of spaces left, and this is like 1 a.m., 1:30 a.m. in the morning. So anyway, I pulled up, and last year, actually, I suppose I should mention as well, I pulled up there at 4 a.m. that time, having driven, I think it was no, maybe a little bit later, I forget, but then, the best part, the place that has the best vantage point was all sort of full up. There was people, all of the cars were already there, and I ended up having to park some way down the road. And it was pretty cool. By the time the sun came up and I could see, there must have been maybe a few hundred, maybe up to even 1,000 people sort of all standing along the side of this mountain, so it was a pretty crazy experience to get into. That was a Saturday, though, if I recall, or a Sunday. I went on a Saturday night and stayed there on the Sunday, so I think that's right. I need to check, but anyway, it was pretty crazy. It was a weekday this time, so I didn't expect it to be that bad, but even at 1:30 a.m. I was one of the last few open free parking spaces. I was surprised to find this year when I pulled up as well that there was like a line of unmanned tripods just sort of lined up along the guardrail at the side of the road, along the edge of the parking area. Not wanting to be left out, I took the Acrotech Ultimate ball head off my Manfrotto tripod and placed it in front of my car, just right there against the guardrail. My car seats actually fold down to like an all-flat configuration, one of the reasons that I bought this car. So me and the better half sort of set about the task of flattening things down and was really just going to try and get some sleep. It was a pretty futile attempt, though, as people were sort of pulling up and scuffling around outside the whole time. Just after 3 a.m., I wiped the condensation off the car window and looked up at the clearest, most beautiful starry sky that I've ever seen. This, of course, sparked the photographer in me, so I decided to get up and after maybe around 30 minutes sleep or so, I started to try my hand at astrophotography. I'd remembered some of the settings and configurations on the MVP forum that people have mentioned in the past, and I sort of set about the task. Then I'd made, I think, maybe 10 minutes into my first exposure, and a real thick mist sort of rolled in, probably just the clouds rolled over the top and pretty much ruined that attempt. After that, I decided to see what I could capture with the 600mm f4 with a 1.4 times extender. The mist was coming in often enough that it was not going to allow me to do any long exposures with the star trails. This was pretty cool, though, to look at the sky through the, basically, what will it be, 120mm lens, 820mm lens, I should say. And, I managed to track down the Orion Nebula, and it was just about possible to make out some colour with the naked eye. And then I tried to make some images, and the colour came out much stronger than I'd expected. The problem is that at 120mm, the stars, I just said it again, 820mm, the stars move so fast that it was not possible to get a sharp image. Even when I sort of cranked the ISO up to 1600. It was nice to play around with this, though, and it really sort of took me back to when I was 11 years old and had a nice little telescope, and I used to spend hours looking through that. Orion was my favourite place to explore then, too, so it was nice to sort of catch up with what really felt like an old friend. By the time I'd done playing around looking at the stars during the gaps, between the mist rolling in and then going out again, it was just after 4 a.m. The sun was set to rise at around 5:40 a.m., but there were so many people wandering around, even at sort of 4 a.m, that I decided to just stake my place at the barrier and wait it out. I'd been using the 600mm, so I'd got the Jitso tripod set up with the 600mm on that and the Manfrotto on the other side, so I was basically just sort of ready there, and I wanted to keep my eye on that as well, rather than just pack it all away and then get it out again a little bit later. The thing was that I'd taken the 600mm along with me, not really for the stars, but because I was hoping to pick out a few parts of the valley below as the sun came up and illuminated everything. So it was really just a good idea to leave it all set up and hang out, waiting around for things to start to heat up. Not the most pleasant tasks, and I guess saying heat up was wishful thinking, because it was about 3 degrees Celsius or 37 degrees Fahrenheit standing on the side of the mountain. I mentioned this last year as well, but there's actually a stone monument sort of thing there with a plaque on it that says that this is the highest point of any road in Japan. It's I think it was just over 2,000 meters, 2,130 meters, something like that. So it's a pretty high place to be standing at this time of the year, so almost at freezing point. The clouds last year as well had sort of had filled the valley and stopped me from getting the sun at the sunrise, you know, as it hit the horizon. But my main objective was to shoot the valley below, not to shoot the sun on the horizon. So this wasn't really a problem. I started to shoot as the light from the sky illuminated the valley and made a few shots of the trees on the edge of the clouds, some later ones that we'll look at later. But then after around 6 a.m., the sun broke over the top of the cloud. So it had been up in the, it had been over the horizon for 20 minutes when it made its way over the top of the clouds in the valley. And it was pretty nice. So, you know, just quickly look at image number 1568, which was shot literally 1 second after 6 a.m., a few moments after the entire sun's disk became visible. Here we can see the sun shot through my 600mm f4 lens at ISO 100 for 1/8000th of a second at f8. This is the fastest shutter speed that the 5D will give me, so I'd started to stop down the aperture to keep the clouds from blowing out too much. Of course, with this much light, it would look more unnatural to not have anything blown out. Of course, the sun's disk is blown out too, but that's par for the course, really. Having a lot of fun in these first few hours, I did continue to play around with the, I got a few images, one of just the sun's disk, where the sun was not really blown out. I won't check the settings right now, but I'd sort of changed the settings a bit and taken a quite dark shot, and it was pretty cool to see the, you know, to look at the sun at 100%. But as a photograph, it didn't really warrant uploading to my online gallery. In this this one, though, that we're looking at now, I was pretty pleased with the formation of the clouds and just thought it was a fun shot to upload and share with you today. I probably should just quickly mention, because I know somebody's going to mail me about this. Yes, it's dangerous to look at the sun through a highly magnified lens, through any lens, I guess. So don't do this at home, children, without being too patronizing there. Trying to be serious here, that we, you know, it is dangerous to look directly at the sun. You can sort of burn your retina. I can almost hear some people in the forum now screaming and shouting about this. They're my eyes, it's, you know, it's my risk, and I do sort of do this sometimes. But if you're in the least bit worried, I would try not to do this. What I generally tend to do is look through for no more than a few seconds at a time, and then sort of take my eyes away from the finder as I'm actually making the exposure and things. But, you know, it's a risk that I take, and I haven't had any problems so far. But like I say, don't try this at home, especially if you want to sort of mail me later and say that you've got some green blotches on your eyes through staring at the sun for 30 seconds. So anyway, in the next shot, which is image number 1571, we can see one of the images shot with the 600mm looking down into the valley. This is what I mentioned earlier, a short while ago, where the edge of the clouds sort of meets the trees on the side of the mountain with the mist there in the valley. I love this sort of shot where the mist forms distinct layers of contrast between the trees. I can count sort of roughly six layers in this shot where the trees drop down into the, you know, back into the mist, being distinctly sort of less visible as they get further back. We can see that the autumn color was coming in pretty well at this location, but I would have been better maybe 5 days or so later on the whole, I think. The timing of this location is incredibly difficult. The good thing here, though, is that because we have the steep sides of the mountain, then, you know, we have multiple stages of color due to the various levels of altitude visible from this location. Still with ISO 100 and an aperture of f8 to get a little bit of depth of field this time, I had to increase the shutter speed to, what was it, 1/30th of a second. And really, now that was just going to get me the right exposure for this time. I was shooting manual mode as usual. This one is really one of my favourites from the trip, though, and by this time I was starting to feel happy about having driven here overnight and sleeping just 30 minutes before starting my day. In the next image, number 1576, we have an image closer to the other end of the focal length range with a 35mm shot of the valley that I was looking down into. This one, shot for 1/80th of a second at f8, really shows the grandeur of the location. I have metered for the greenery and again lost some detail in the sea of clouds, but really, again, not too worried about that. I did shoot 5 frames, bracketed frames of this very scene, which I tried some HDR with. But as I viewed the results, it looked great initially, but as I reviewed the results close up, I noticed that the software had not done a good job of aligning the trees, you know, the branches of the trees and the leaves in what looks like grass here. It's actually lots of leaves. There was lots of sort of fuzziness in there. And, you know, I was thinking that although it would have looked great for the web, as I actually sort of sell prints from the website as well, I wouldn't really have been able to have sold that as a fine art print. So I went back to this single cut. This was one of the 5, but it was the one that sort of had got the best sort of tonal range and everything from the batch. We can see the edge of the clouds here that I'd singled out a portion of for the last image. And as the line of clouds moves up and down the mountain, I was faced with a number of similar scenes, which I had sort of kept shooting for a while. I had the 600mm on one tripod and was switching between that and the 70 to 200mm on the other tripod, and then also switching that out with the 16 to 35 from time to time to sort of get some more wider angle stuff. I was really wishing that I had 2 bodies at this point. Using 2 tripods with only 1 body was not ideal, but I only have the 5D at the moment, so it wasn't possible to use 2. In image number 1581, we can see that I've headed back down the mountain by 8 a.m. and was now shooting at the Ichinuma Pond, or the number 1 pond, which we'd also looked at last year. This is a beautiful spot at this time of year, and this is one of my favourite images from that first morning. The colours were great, but the angle of the sun here was still low enough in the sky and around the back, sort of, you know, to the side of these trees. So there was various levels of light hitting the different areas of the scene, which I find quite appealing. Of course, the thing that makes this shot even better is the reflection of the trees in the surface of the pond. I'm also happy with the positioning of that brightly lit bush in the far left, holding our eye in the frame. And my favourite part of this location is, you know, in general, is that the silver birches, or the white birch trees, that add contrast and interest to the scene. I shot this particular image with an aperture of f11 for 1/20th of a second with ISO 100. I wanted to get as much of the trees, though, in the foreground, in focus, so I had stopped down a little bit, you know, I say in the foreground, from through the, you know, the trees in the foreground to through to the background, I should say. So I'd stop down a little bit to f11. I try not to go much smaller than f11, though, and when possible sort of stick to f8 because it's just so sharp. It often makes up for the slightly shallower depth of field, I think, especially when shooting from a distance like I was here. My better half was sleeping in the car at this time, and you know, the other shots that I uploaded from around the same time and not long after this, we're all sort of done with just me wandering around a little bit in a daze through lack of sleep. So I went back to the car, drove around the corner and sort of moved into a large car park, the back of a large car park actually, under some similarly coloured trees, and just sort of reclined the seat a bit, staring out at the beautiful trees, just got myself a few hours sleep. The light was starting to get pretty harsh by this time as well, so it wasn't really any big loss. And there was a few hours before we could check into the hotel anyway, so caught up on a little bit of sleep there. And then really just spent much of the rest of the day having checked in at noon, just sort of driving around the mountain and shooting here and there. Whole bunch of shots uploaded from this time into the online gallery. And I'm going to put a link into the show notes that will show all of them if you're interested in looking a little bit more. Having gone to a certain place later in the afternoon, hoping to catch that in the last hours or so of the daylight, the clouds rolled in again. Happens a lot here, I'll talk about it a little bit later, but pretty much engulfed the mountain, so it was not going to happen on that day. So there wasn't a lot else towards the end of the day that I uploaded. But then when we went back to the hotel and just sort of started to think about relaxing and thinking about catching up with a little bit more sleep before dinner, the missus looked out of the window and saw some Japanese macaques rummaging around in the long grass at the side of the hotel. Never wanting to waste a photo opportunity, the sleepiness sort of flew away somewhere, and I put the 1.4 times extender on the 70 to 200 millimeter f2.8 lens and headed outside. And this is where I shot image number 1584. This isn't really a great image. There's lots of grain from using ISO 1250. As we were sort of well into twilight at this point, but I like the feel of the monkey sort of sitting there in the long grass, and the bokeh sort of turned out quite nice too. So I decided to upload it. The macaque seemingly has its eyes fixed on something in the grass for just a moment. The next frame of this series was actually the monkey stripping seeds off the grass with its teeth, looking pretty fierce. But I chose to go with this one. It's just overall more pleasing. I was surprised to see that the group of macaques was around 30 to 40 strong. And they were sort of in the grass at the side of the hotel and down the road into the valley. Not far, maybe only, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 meters of elevation where I was standing. But down there, then we have the ski lifts. There's a ski ground on the opposite side of the valley from the hotel, and I was sort of enjoying photographing them myself, but the locals were definitely they'd had their fill. One guy came out of a shop with a big stick and started waving it around, scaring the monkeys away. Another guy actually drove a car at the group, obviously trying to hit them, which I found a little bit disturbing. They can be a bit of a pest, but I can never help thinking about, who was here first. We, humans have encroached into the monkey's environment, so I'd prefer to see a little bit more patience, but then again, I don't live here, so I probably shouldn't comment. One thing that I will go on to say, though, is that, you have to be a little bit careful with these macaques these days. They are powerful creatures, especially the large males, and they've turned quite nasty in recent years because people have stopped feeding them. You used to be able to sort of buy food for them in these touristy areas, and people used to, they'd buy a bag of this food, feed them, or just feed them anything on hand, some, I was going to say crisps from the UK, but I guess potato chips for the US listeners. Anything that you have on hand, people used to feed them. A lot like a similar sort of feeling, really, to feeding the pigeons, I guess. But the macaque became pretty reliant on this and stopped going back into the mountains in many places. And they'd hang around in towns and then get a little bit cheeky and snatch food from people and scare the kids, etc. And to really force them back to a more natural way of living, the general tendency now is not to feed them. It's banned in most places that I can think of. And this has really confused the macaque. For years, humans have given them all sorts of goodies and made a fuss of them. And now, because they're not allowed to feed them, they sort of turn the other way and, you know, ignore them, really. And this is frustrating the hell out of them. So there are now, there's new stories of how vicious the macaque are becoming in certain towns, and, you know, this sort of semi-humorous footage of the monkeys going into stores and stealing sweets from the from the stores, and it's the very sweets that people were feeding them for so many years. And I've actually seen this firsthand in a number of times in the area of Nikko, which we visited on this podcast a few times. And I really just can't help thinking that these guys have been given a bit of a bum deal by us humans again. But, you know, I mean, that's the same old story, I guess. So, you know, I'm looking at the timer on my audio recording software right now, and we've just about to hit the 26-minute mark. I had planned to do this in one fell swoop, but I've got a fair amount to look at still. We've got five more shots that I'm planning right now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to break this off here, and we'll do the ending, and then I'll record a second part that I'll either I'll probably release next week now. I don't really want to go on for maybe what will be like an hour just in one fell swoop. So let's call it a day for now, and we'll catch up again next week. So, like I say, we'll make that it for today. I wanted to just really quickly apologise for the podcast being a little bit late again this week, as it has been in recent weeks. I've been taking on lots of little projects, and you know, in addition to sort of being busy in my day job, but this week what I've been doing is putting together a short essay for a web magazine that's approached me recently. And I wanted to mention before we finish that the plan is to release a PDF on this podcast in the next few weeks. If I've done a little bit of customization, and if all that goes well, the feed should just really house a PDF file instead of an audio file at some time. It'll probably be the week after next now. So when that happens, you know, don't be too worried. It's not a mistake. I just want to give you a sort of a heads up here and let you know that it's going to happen. What I'm going to probably do is also pretty much read out the document. It's 15 pages with all in, but it's about maybe there's, I don't know, 10 to 12 pages in there that you really want that's actual text. So I'll read that out and probably, or the key points to that, and probably make that into an audio podcast as well. Just because I know that a lot of you actually, you know, you listen to the podcast, and you don't really, you know, that your listening habits are not going to be too conducive to sort of reading a 15-page document. So, you know, most of you listen during your commutes or you know, at work and things like that, I hear. So I'll probably record it as well, but they'll both be released at the same time. It'll be like probably episode 111.1 and 111.2 or something like that. And basically, you know, it's a nice little document. I made it in Microsoft Word and then exported it as a PDF. I don't have Acrobat, so it's not a proper PDF, a really sort of fully fledged PDF file, but you'll need the Acrobat or the Adobe Reader for that to be able to read it. And it'll just be downloadable through iTunes or directly from the website as usual. Remember that the Hokkaido workshop is planned for the end of January, beginning of February next year. So if you're interested in that, please do go over to www.mbpworkshops.com and take a look at the details there. But that's about it for today. So I guess all that remains to be said is thanks very much for listening. And we'll continue this what's now a two-part series next week. So thanks very much. Bye-bye.
PhotocastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotocastNetwork.com. www.yourphotographyresource.com.